About 280 million people are living with depression right now. Most of them haven't told anyone. Not their doctor, not their partner, not their closest friend. They're going to work, making dinner, laughing at the right moments, and inside there is nothing. Or worse than nothing. Welcome to Claude Talks. I'm Emma.
And I'm Ryan. And today we're going to talk about depression. Not the word people throw around when they're having a bad day. Not I'm so depressed about this traffic. The real thing. Major depressive disorder. The thing that steals months, sometimes years, from people's lives.
And I want to be upfront about something before we start. This one is personal for me. I went through a period a few years back where I was depressed. Not situationally sad. Clinically depressed. And I'll come back to what that actually felt like because I think the lived experience matters as much as the science.
And we're going to do the science justice today, too. Because there's a lot of outdated stuff out there, the chemical imbalance narrative, the idea that you just need more serotonin, and the science has genuinely moved on. We're going to tell you what we actually know. Which is more interesting, and honestly more hopeful.
Let's start with what depression actually is. Because I think the biggest misunderstanding is that it's sadness. It isn't. Or at least not primarily. The technical term for what makes depression distinct is anhedonia. The inability to feel pleasure. Things that used to make you happy just don't. You eat your favorite meal and it tastes like cardboard. You hear a song you used to love and it reaches you through glass.
That's such an accurate way to put it. The glass wall metaphor. You can see life happening, you can see people being happy, you can intellectually understand that you used to be one of them, but you can't get through to it.
Churchill famously called his depression the black dog, this looming aggressive thing that followed him around. And I understand that metaphor. But for me it was less like a predator and more like the volume got turned down on everything. Colors were duller. Sounds were quieter. My own thoughts were slow and heavy. It wasn't an emotion. It was the absence of emotion.
Which is a crucial distinction because it tells us something about what's actually happening in the brain. This isn't just feeling bad. The diagnostic criteria for major depressive disorder require 5 or more symptoms persisting for at least 2 weeks, and crucially, the list includes things like fatigue, cognitive slowing, changes in sleep and appetite, physical restlessness or its opposite, psychomotor retardation, where you literally move and think more slowly, and recurrent thoughts of death.
And the thing that gets me about that list is how physical it is. People don't always realize that. When I was in it, I felt physically heavy. Getting out of bed wasn't laziness. It was like gravity had doubled.
That's actually physiologically real, by the way. We'll get into the neuroscience. But the other type worth mentioning is persistent depressive disorder, used to be called dysthymia. It's milder than MDD, but it's chronic. It can last years. And because it's lower grade, people often just absorb it into their identity.
I've always been like this. I'm just a pessimist. I've never really been a happy person. That story people tell about themselves.
Exactly. And it's worth pausing on that because chronic low-grade depression is often undertreated precisely because people don't recognize it as depression at all. There's also a useful distinction between situational or reactive depression, triggered by a loss, a trauma, a major life event, and what used to be called endogenous depression, which seems to arise without a clear external cause. Though modern psychiatry is increasingly skeptical of drawing a hard line between those two.
Because the brain doesn't really care whether there was a trigger. Once it's in that state, the mechanisms are similar.
Right. Which brings us to those mechanisms. And this is where I want to spend some real time, because what we were all taught, what was in every explainer video for 20 years, is genuinely incomplete. The chemical imbalance story. Low serotonin causes depression. Take an SSRI to top it up. Depression fixed.
And to be clear, we're not saying antidepressants don't work. They do for many people. We'll come back to that. But the serotonin hypothesis as an explanation for depression? In 2022, a major umbrella review by Joanna Moncrief and colleagues looked at all the evidence for a link between serotonin levels and depression and found essentially none. No consistent evidence that depressed people have lower serotonin. no consistent evidence that artificially raising serotonin relieves depression.
Which reignited a massive debate. And some headlines ran wild with antidepressants don't work. Which is also wrong. So let me try to explain the nuance, because it matters.
Please.
The serotonin hypothesis was always a simplification. It was partly a backwards inference, SSRIs affect serotonin and they seem to help, therefore serotonin must be the problem. That's like saying aspirin relieves headaches, aspirin reduces inflammation, therefore all headaches are caused by inflammation. The drug working doesn't prove the theory about the cause.
So what do we actually know?
A few things that are much more interesting. First, the neuroinflammation hypothesis. There's growing evidence that in a significant subset of depression, the immune system is involved. Elevated cytokines, inflammation markers, are found in many depressed patients. Chronic inflammatory conditions like rheumatoid arthritis and IBD have much higher rates of depression. And in some trials, anti-inflammatory drugs have shown antidepressant effects. Depression may, in part, be an immune-mediated condition.
Which explains why infections, chronic illness, even just being sedentary and unhealthy can trigger or maintain depression.
Exactly. Second, the HPA axis, the stress response system. Chronic stress causes prolonged cortisol release and over time, that physically damages the brain. The hippocampus, the region involved in memory and emotional regulation, actually shrinks in people with chronic depression. BDNF, a protein critical for neuroplasticity and growing new neurons, drops significantly. Depression literally changes the brain structure.
And that's reversible? With treatment?
Yes. Antidepressants, exercise, psychotherapy, all of them increase BDNF. The hippocampus can regrow. That's one reason treatment works, and one reason it takes time.
And then there's the ketamine story.
Which is genuinely fascinating. Ketamine, a completely different drug, acting on glutamate receptors, nothing to do with serotonin, produces rapid antidepressant effects. Sometimes within hours. In treatment-resistant cases where nothing else has worked. That discovery effectively proved that serotonin can't be the whole picture. There's a whole glutamate system involved, and the NMDA receptor pathway is now a major area of research.
And there's the default mode network finding, which I find almost poetic in how it describes what depression feels like from the inside.
The default mode network is the brain's self-referential system, the network that's active when you're thinking about yourself, replaying memories, imagining the future, thinking about what other people think of you. In depression, it's hyperactive. The brain gets stuck in a loop of self-referential thought.
Rumination.
Exactly. And this brings us neatly to the cognitive side. Because the neuroscience and the psychology are telling the same story from different angles. Aaron Beck, the psychiatrist who developed cognitive behavioral therapy, identified what he called the cognitive triad. In depression, you develop systematically negative views of yourself, the world, and the future. Not just I'm having a bad day, but I am fundamentally flawed, the world is hostile, and nothing will ever get better.
And those thoughts feel true. That's the thing. When I was depressed, I wasn't thinking these are distorted thoughts caused by a brain condition. I was thinking, I have finally seen reality clearly. I'm just being realistic.
Which is perhaps the cruelest cognitive feature of depression. It presents its distortions as insight.
And the thoughts are fast. Automatic. Before you can catch them, you've already been told you're worthless, you're a burden, you'll never get better. There's this cognitive phenomenon called automatic negative thoughts. They're faster and more persistent in depression than any positive thought can be.
The cognitive distortions are also worth naming. All or nothing thinking, I made one mistake, I'm a complete failure. Catastrophizing. Mental filtering, only noticing the negative evidence and discarding the positive. Personalization, everything bad is somehow your fault. These aren't character flaws. They're patterns that depression trains into the brain.
And then there's what I think of as the energy paradox. Depression drains the energy you need to do the things that would help you. Exercise helps, but you can't move. Seeing people helps, but you can't face it. The condition protects itself.
Let's talk about risk factors, because there are some things that are often misunderstood here too. Depression has a genetic component, about 40% heritability for major depressive disorder. That's meaningful. But compare it to bipolar disorder at 70 to 80%, MDD is much more influenced by environment. The genetic risk loads the gun. Life pulls the trigger.
And childhood adversity is one of the strongest predictors we know of. The ACE score, Adverse Childhood Experiences, maps almost linearly to adult depression risk. Early trauma changes the way the stress system is calibrated. It makes you more reactive, more prone to that HPA dysregulation Ryan described.
First episodes are almost always triggered, a loss, a trauma, a sustained period of chronic stress. But here's something called the kindling hypothesis that I find important. Each depressive episode lowers the threshold for the next. After three episodes, the recurrence rate is over 90%, meaning at that point, the condition has become somewhat self-sustaining. Which is an argument for taking treatment seriously even after you feel better.
There are also contributing factors that are underappreciated. Sleep disruption, bidirectionally related to depression, chronic pain, thyroid dysfunction. A significant number of people diagnosed with depression actually have hypothyroidism, and treating the thyroid resolves the mood symptoms. Vitamin D deficiency, and social isolation, which is both a consequence of depression and one of its most powerful drivers.
The isolation trap. You feel depressed, you withdraw. You withdraw, the depression worsens. The longer you're isolated, the harder it is to break back into social contact.
I lived that. At my worst, I had stopped answering messages. Not because I didn't care about people, I did. But responding felt like an enormous task, and I was convinced I had nothing worth saying. And then the silence got longer, and the shame about the silence grew, and that made it even harder to reach out.
Let's talk treatment. Because this is where there's actually a lot of reason for hope, and also a lot of misinformation.
Start with the medications because people are confused.
SSRIs and SNRIs, the standard first-line antidepressants. The evidence is that they work. But the effect size on average is modest, a number needed to treat of around 7, meaning for every 7 people who take them, roughly 1 gets a meaningful benefit they wouldn't have gotten from placebo. That sounds low, and critics like Irving Kirsch have used this to argue they're essentially expensive placebos.
But that average hides something important.
It does. Effect size varies hugely by severity. For mild depression, antidepressants barely outperform placebo. For severe depression, the benefit is substantial and very real. So the nuanced position is, medication is most appropriate for moderate to severe depression, it takes 4 to 6 weeks to work, and it works better when combined with therapy.
And the combination is key. Studies consistently show that therapy plus medication outperforms either alone.
Psychotherapy has excellent evidence. CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, is the gold standard, focused on identifying and challenging those distorted thought patterns. ACT, acceptance and commitment therapy, takes a different angle, focused on changing your relationship to thoughts rather than the content of them. But one of the most powerful and underrated interventions is something called behavioral activation.
Which is almost counterintuitively simple.
It is. The premise is, don't wait for motivation to do things. Do the things, and motivation follows. Depression inverts the usual motivational sequence. It tells you when you feel better, you'll want to do things. Behavioral activation says, go do the thing first. Even if you don't want to. Even if it feels hollow. The doing creates a crack in the depression. Studies show it can be as effective as full CBT for many people.
Exercise deserves its own paragraph.
It really does. The evidence is robust and kind of astonishing. 3 sessions a week of aerobic exercise produces antidepressant effects comparable to SSRIs for mild to moderate depression. The mechanism is real. Exercise directly increases BDNF, stimulates neurogenesis in the hippocampus, reduces inflammation, regulates cortisol. This isn't go for a walk and cheer up. This is a biological intervention.
The challenge is the energy paradox again. Depression makes exercise feel impossible, which is why starting tiny matters. A 10-minute walk, not a workout, a walk.
For treatment-resistant cases, where multiple antidepressants haven't worked, there are now good options. Ketamine and esketamine, marketed as Spravato, is FDA-approved for treatment-resistant depression. It acts within hours rather than weeks. Transcranial magnetic stimulation uses targeted magnetic pulses to modulate specific brain regions. And then there's ECT, electroconvulsive therapy,
which I want to address directly because the cultural baggage around ECT is enormous and mostly inaccurate.
ECT has one of the strongest evidence bases in all of psychiatry. For severe, treatment-resistant depression, including cases where someone is at imminent risk, it is the most effective treatment we have. Modern ECT is done under general anesthesia, involves a brief controlled seizure, and patients wake up with no memory of the procedure. The side effects, mainly short-term memory disruption, are real but manageable. The image most people have comes from films made 60 years ago depicting something that no longer exists.
For seasonal depression, the kind that recurs in winter, light therapy is highly effective and criminally underused. A light box, 10,000 lux, 30 minutes in the morning. That's it. Strong evidence, no side effects.
Let's talk about what actually helps versus what doesn't. Because some of the most natural-seeming responses to a depressed person are actually counterproductive.
Just try to see the positive side. Others have it so much worse. You have so much to be grateful for. Those things don't help. They're not wrong as observations, they're just not what someone in depression can access. It's like telling someone with a broken leg to just walk it off.
And lying in bed all day feels right, rest, recover, but for depression it typically makes things worse. Not because you should force yourself to be relentlessly productive, but because total withdrawal and sleep excess are maintaining factors.
Sunlight, contact with other humans even briefly, movement, those are the things that help, even when they feel impossible, even when they feel hollow.
And on the isolation side, reaching out to someone who's depressed matters enormously. Not with advice. Not with silver linings. Just I'm here. Knowing they're not alone in it is one of the most therapeutic things that can happen.
I want to say something about suicide because we can't do an honest episode about depression without it. Depression significantly raises suicide risk. And one of the persistent myths is that if you ask someone directly, "Are you thinking about suicide?" you might plant the idea. That's been studied. It's not true. Asking directly opens a door. Tells the person, "This is something we can talk about. I'm not afraid of it. You're not going to scare me away."
If you're worried about someone, ask directly. It takes courage. But it's one of the most protective things you can do.
Let me bring this back to the human scale for a moment. 280 million people worldwide. The most common mental illness on Earth. The average untreated episode lasts 6 to 12 months. With treatment that shortens significantly, about half of people who have one episode will have another. After three episodes, recurrence is nearly certain, which is why maintenance treatment, staying on therapy or medication even when you feel well, matters.
And depression is not a character flaw. It is not weakness. It is not something you push through by deciding to feel better. It is a medical condition with biological, psychological, and social dimensions, each of which can be addressed with real, evidence-based tools.
When I came out the other side of my depression, and I did come out the other side, I remember the day things started to feel real again. Not dramatic. I was making coffee and I noticed the smell. Actually noticed it. And I stood there for a long time just smelling coffee, because I hadn't been able to experience anything fully for months. And that small thing felt like getting a piece of myself back.
That's a beautiful way to describe recovery.
It came back incrementally, not all at once. And not because I pushed through it or cheered up or counted my blessings. Came back because I got help. I talked to someone. I started moving again. I took a medication that helped me get functional enough to start doing the other things. It was a combination of everything and it worked.
And that's the evidence too. It's not one thing. It's usually several things together. And the more severe the depression, the more important it is to get professional support rather than trying to manage alone.
If you're in it right now, and statistically some people listening to this are, I want to say this directly, what you're experiencing is real. It's not weakness. It's not permanent, even though it feels permanent. Episodes end. Lives get rebuilt. The glass wall does come down.
And if you're trying to support someone in it, show up. You don't need the right words. I'm here is enough. Keep showing up even when they don't respond. Ask the direct questions. Don't flinch. That persistence is what breaks through.
The resources are real, the treatments work, the science is better than it's ever been. We are not where we were with depression 20 years ago, and we're genuinely not where we'll be in 20 more.
That's all for today's Claude Talks. If this episode resonated with you, share it with someone who might need it. Or don't share it, just hold it for yourself. Either is fine.
Take care of each other. We'll see you next time.